Scripture reading this evening is taken from Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, and we read in chapter 11 and from the first verse. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 1. I hope you will put up with a little of my foolishness, but you're already doing that. I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. But I do not think I am in the least inferior to those super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge. We have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. And when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. I have kept myself from being a burden to you in any way, and will continue to do so. As surely as the truth of Christ is in me, nobody in the regions of Achaia will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I do not love you. God knows I do. And I will keep on doing what I am doing in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising, then, if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading of his holy word. Now turn with me, please, to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, the passage we read together earlier. I'm going to begin this evening by asking you to write a list of things in your mind, of things you believe prevent people from discovering the truth about Jesus and growing in their knowledge of him. You've got a second or two to do that. And I wonder if in the process of so doing, anyone had thought of the word gullibility. For that would have been at the top of Paul's list as he thought of the church at Corinth. What was doing great damage to this congregation, to this people in Corinth? Quite simply, in a word, Paul would say, gullibility. Gullibility. A.W. Tozer has this to say. He says, "Faith never means gullibility. The man who believes everything is as far from God as the man who refuses to believe anything." The man who believes everything is as far from God as the man who refuses to believe anything. And the church at Corinth were too ready to believe anything, to believe what others told them. And this is what lay behind much of the confusion which existed in the church at Corinth. And the sad irony of Paul's situation in writing to this church is this, that Paul, a true apostle of Jesus Christ, was being accused of being a false apostle by the very people who were themselves false apostles. This forces Paul into the embarrassing position that he finds himself in verse 11 of blowing his own trumpet. He says, "I feel like an idiot." But then Solomon has advised us to answer a fool according to his folly. And Paul is saying here in these opening verses, since I am already an object of ridicule in the eyes of many, let me risk making a still bigger fool of myself by telling you how I feel about you. I am jealous for you, he says, with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. In this passage, Paul is not making all the fuss that he makes for the sake of his own good name. That meant very little to him. But because there was a far larger issue at stake. For Paul's opponents were trying to undermine not simply Paul, but the very gospel which he proclaimed. They felt that Paul's Christianity needed a bit of a facelift. They wanted a Christianity that was going to be more acceptable to the Greek culture of their day, and Paul saw something quite sinister in that. Something devilish. He saw the church being seduced, a bride being drawn away from her love for and commitment to the person of Christ. And he sees a pattern re-emerging that was first seen to operate in Eden when Eve was seduced by Satan and drawn away from her commitment to God. We discover that Paul is fiercely possessive of the church he had founded, really just as a father would be jealous of his daughter. Or for his daughter. Not the kind of possessive father who says, "I'm never going to let my daughter go, you're never going to leave home, you're never going to marry, you're always going to be your daddy's girl." Paul wanted to give his daughter away. But he wanted to give his daughter away to the one she was engaged to, and to whom she rightly belonged, to Christ himself. And in the interim, he is clearly concerned that the church would be compromised by her flirtation with the world. Look at verse 4. "For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. Paul, you see, is appalled that they have got more time for spiritual gigolos than they do for him, their spiritual father. Paul doesn't question the orthodoxy of these spiritual gigolos. There are no obvious heretical errors being taught in the church at Corinth by these so-called super apostles. Their error lay in their methodology and their style of leadership. They wanted to present a gospel that was going to appeal to the society of their day. A gospel that majored on strength and not on weakness. In heavenly triumph and not on earthly suffering. In other words, they wanted a gospel that played down the cross and played up the glory. For they were persuaded, you see, that it was the glory that was the selling point of Christianity. And this is the seduction that infuriated Paul. So in the course of this passage, we find him making a threefold defense of his apostolic ministry. And that defense is found in verses 6 to 15. One charge leveled against the apostle was that his ministry lacked polish. If you look at verse 6, I may not be a trained speaker, he said, but I do have knowledge. We have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. By the standards of the Greek orators of Paul's day, his public communication was really pretty ordinary. Paul's opponents in Corinth seem to have dazzled the congregation by their eloquence. Here are preachers who got carried away by their showmanship. Disraeli once said of Gladstone that he was inebriated by the exuberance of his own verbosity. In other words, he got high in public speaking. He got intoxicated by the sound of his own voice, and ordinary people hadn't a clue what he was saying. And in contrast to that, you see, Paul's preaching was plain and unvarnished, but he did have content. He communicated truth. His preaching was informed. Paul believed that content was much more important than polish, and that persuaded him that he was not an inferior communicator. But secondly, Paul was accused of being unprofessional. Verse 7. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? You see, Paul did not charge for his evangelism. There is a mindset around, you know, that suggests that the more you pay for something, the more it must be worth. This has helped designer labels to really take off in our own day. The more you pay for it, the more it's worth. It's the name in your trainers that's important, isn't it? Not how good they are or how comfortably they are, it's the name. And how much you paid for them. This mindset is also evident in the third world. I remember when we were in Pakistan, we found the people there that believed the more they paid for medicine, then the better it must be. And they would often go out and buy very expensive medication, which would have done their condition no good at all. But they were persuaded because it cost so much. It was bound to be of great benefit and help to them. Well, Paul's rivals had tapped into this mindset, suggesting that if Paul's evangelism came free of charge, if he failed, unlike them, to charge a proper fee for his evangelism, then he really couldn't have been worth much as a preacher. Paul's response is that the inexpensiveness of his ministry was not a mark of amateurism, but a carefully developed missionary strategy. As far as Paul was concerned, it would have cheapened the gospel to make people pay for it. He would be reducing himself to the level of a professional entertainer. And like so many religious charlatans in the ancient world, selling religion for money. And Paul's boast was that he was not in the business of evangelizing for money. And he intended to keep things the way they were. He did, you will notice, however, allow other Christians elsewhere to provide voluntarily for his needs. But that was quite a different matter for charging a fee for evangelism. So much so that the logic of his opponents defies him, that his failure to charge the Corinthians for his evangelism was indicative of the fact that he didn't really love them. That's what they were told in Corinth. If Paul had loved you, he would have charged you more. He charged you nothing. He couldn't have loved you. And he's saying, the logic of that, it defies me. We find in verses 13 to 15 that Paul's irony disappears, and we discover precisely what he thinks of these so-called super apostles. For when Satan comes to injure the church, he dresses himself up like a Christian. Imitation and counterfeit are his stock in trade. And this is how he introduces confusion to the church. Christians are lured away from the path of truth by plausible charm and by deceptive subterfuge. Now, just as there are, I believe, a number of tests devised by banks to authenticate banknotes so that they know they're getting the real thing, so too there are tests that we can apply to those who purport to be the representatives of Christ. There are two distinguishing marks, if you like, which the devil is incapable of removing from his product. And they are moral quality and final destination. The tongues of Satan's agents may sound spiritual, but their lives always, always bear a telltale trademark: the produce of hell. And one day that is where they are going, verse 15. Their end will be what their actions deserve. So the greatest problem of the Christian church is not materialism, it's not scientific skepticism. It's really the growth of public gullibility. It was Chesterton who said that when people abandon truth, they do not believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And there are thousands of sects in the world today which we might expect would strain the credulity of simple Simons in the things that they claim and the things that they teach. But their numerical success does indicate that people are prepared to believe anything. And it's with this in mind that I think it's incumbent upon us to apply a passage such as this to our own lives and to our own situation and to those that we come into contact with. And there are three things here that I want to mention in closing this evening. A threefold application. And the first is, don't let words fool you. Paul's rivals were good with words. And I suppose that really shouldn't be a surprise to us, because the devil is a master of persuasion. Clever words are his stock in trade. Sometimes he uses flattery to massage our egos and feed our intellectual pride. We can feel that we're beginning to live in the edge of excitement when we listen to the very latest in theological speculation. We can find ourselves asking, how did we ever get any satisfaction from that old-fashioned conservative theology that we used to believe? Now, you may be sitting there this evening and saying, but wait a minute. We are the Burgetti Fellowship. How could we ever fall for anything like that? Let me tell you this. A man who came to be a household name in Scotland and who was himself an exponent of liberal anti-supernatural theology was in his early life an open-air street preacher who encouraged faith in the gospel that in later years he began to ridicule. Once he preached it, and in later years he ended up ridiculing it. You see, it flatters our egos to tell ourselves that these new ideas are for truly intelligent Christians. And all this old stuff is for fuddy-duddies who've never really crept out of the Victorian era. We believe that listening to the new stuff will cause us to truly arrive. Oh, we can flatter our egos. But the devil also makes great use of distorted words. He can use the same vocabulary as biblical Christianity, but subtly pour different meaning into those self-same words. In other words, he redefines the words that we are familiar with and daily use. And this is precisely what was happening in Corinth. For these false teachers were happy to talk about Jesus and the Spirit and the Gospel, but the content that they poured into all of these words was quite different. And so they confused the Corinthians by communicating what was false behind a facade of orthodoxy. And you see, that is precisely what so many of the heretical sects have done throughout history. When a Jehovah's Witness comes to your door, he will be quite happy to say that Jesus is the Son of God. But he means something that is entirely different from what Orthodox Christians mean by that statement. He will use the words, but he'll pour a different content into them. He will redefine them to suit his own twisted position. And so we need to be in our guard against being fooled by mere words. And these false teachers demonstrate more clearly than anything else that you don't need to be outspoken in heretical views to be false to the gospel. Indeed, I suspect that you would be hard-pressed, reading through 2 Corinthians, you would be hard-pressed to make any charge of heresy stick against these super apostles. Their great error lay in surrendering the gospel to the secular mood of their day. And this showed in the method of their evangelism, in the emphasis of their preaching, in their style of leadership. They played down the cross and they played up the glory. And that swing was enough for Paul to put them into the devil's camp. Worldliness isn't to be confused with false teaching. Worldliness is often found in genuine Orthodox churches. Someone has said, worldliness is not the result of having no cross in your theology. It is the result of having no cross in your life. You see, you can have perfectly orthodox theology, but in the way in which you seek to communicate the gospel and live your life, you can do something that is quite, quite different. So his first point is, don't let words fool you. Secondly, he is saying, and this is the application that we can take from this passage, don't be naive about money. Paul regarded the way in which his evangelistic work was financed as enormously important. And he took a firm line in this matter for two reasons. First, he realized that money can corrupt a preacher. If you want to identify a questionable group in the Christian world, take a look at their bank accounts. Find out where the money has come from and where the money goes, and you might be in for some big surprises. For successful religion is big business in today's world. And there are people around who are only too eager to exploit the religious market. And one of the reasons Paul refused to allow the Corinthians to support him materially as he evangelized in their midst was that he wanted to separate himself from those who peddled the gospel for financial gain. He was a preacher and not a salesman. Now, Paul was prepared to allow congregations of God's people to support him in his missionary task, but he was not prepared to accept fees for evangelistic services rendered. Can you imagine walking along the Clydeside and you see someone in the river and they're drowning, and as they come up for a third time and they shout, help, help, you say, well, what's it worth to pull you out? And you say, but you wouldn't do that, not to save a man's life. Well, you've made my point for me. That's what Paul is saying here. In evangelizing, I don't go around and say, I'll only tell you the good news if you make it worth my while. For that can not only corrupt the preacher, it can actually alter the way in which people perceive not only the preacher but the gospel. Paul didn't want to be paid, you see, for a good performance. And some people can so easily view an evangelistic meeting, maybe with great singing and stimulating addresses, they can view an evangelistic meeting as a piece of entertainment. And they contribute in much the same way as they would throw something into the cap of a busker. He did a good job. He deserves it. For this very reason, Paul is determined to retain his amateur status. He didn't want people to see themselves as his fans. For once we see preaching as a professional career, we are well on our way to exchanging the high calling of God for a place in the amusement business, where we can so easily be tempted to say the kind of things that we know will keep the fans happy. And so the apostle is saying, don't be naive about money. The third application that we could draw from this passage is the need for us to guard against sentimentality. I suppose in reading through this passage, there might be a tendency for some of us to think that Paul was being unduly severe in describing his opponents as false apostles and deceitful workmen. Strong language. After all, we can all make mistakes. Shouldn't we be more tolerant, Paul, of people such as these? You see, as far as Paul was concerned, these individuals were not merely innocently deluded Christian brothers who needed fuller instruction in God's word. He saw them as agents of Satan, sabotaging, deliberately sabotaging the church. Those who feel Paul as being unduly harsh are probably those who reject any possibility of demonic infiltration into the church. But we need to remember this. Jesus' own intimate band of disciples contained one of whom Jesus said in John chapter 6 and verse 70, have I not chosen you the 12? Yet one of you is a devil. And of course, John goes on to tell us he meant Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, who, though one of the 12, was later to betray him. When we speak of a loving tolerance for all views in the church, we are often describing what is little more than ill-informed sentimentality. And sentimentality is undiscriminating love. And Christian love can never be undiscriminating. Genuine Christian tolerance is a virtue born of a strong conviction that the truth will in time vindicate itself. Compare that with modern humanistic tolerance, which is a vice born of mass indecision about the truth. and which dare not confess any particular belief for fear of being accused of narrow-mindedness. You see the difference between Christian tolerance and humanistic tolerance. Now we find Paul tells us in verse 11 that he loved the Corinthian church. But that did not stop him from denouncing those whom he saw as agents of Satan, who were drawing the hearts of the congregation away from the true gospel. Indeed, it was his love for the church that made him behave in the way he did. He says, "I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy." You see, the most important things aren't the things about which all men agree, but those that they're willing to fight for. Now, of course, it is possible to fight over trivia, and sadly, there are many examples of that in the history of the church. But it is a greater mistake, you see, to refuse to fight over anything at all. And we really do delude ourselves if we believe that all men, without exception, are struggling together to discover truth. The one whom Jesus described as the father of lies is at work in the world and in the church. And his aim is to sow untruth. And we need to learn to resist him and not to be sentimental about tolerance. Let's give room in the church to the devil's lies. Let's be tolerant. Let's be open-minded. One of the most dangerous things which affects the life and the direction of the church is that she comes to be made up of gullible Christians. The real danger in the church is not unbelief, but wrong belief. Not skepticism, but superstition. Not irreligion, but gullibility. Not the doubter, but the deceiver. It is the subtle infiltration of saboteurs who exploit the gullibility of Christian people. And in a world like ours, where leading churchmen deny the atoning power of Christ's death, or the historicity of the resurrection, and where TV evangelists can become millionaires overnight without blinking an eyelid, and numerous cults claim more members than some mainstream Christian denominations, we need to learn to guard against being fooled by words, against being naive about money, against being sentimental about tolerance. May God help us to purpose in our hearts, with his help, to refuse to be gullible Christians.